Das ist Kunst. Der Podcast der Deichtorhallen Hamburg.
I've always been interested in failure and how to read the contemporary moment in terms of failure. Obviously, all systems are functioning, but all systems are constantly failing.
Das nachfolgende Interview mit der US-amerikanischen Künstlerin und Filmemacherin Sarah Morris habe ich auf Englisch geführt. The following interview with Sarah Morris was held in English. Das Versagen von Systemen, das nicht funktionieren, war schon 1989 Thema eines der ersten künstlerischen Projekte von Sarah Morris. Defunct hat sie damals ein manifestartiges Magazin genannt, auf Deutsch nicht mehr existierend. Bei einer kleinen internen Führung vor Eröffnung ihrer aktuellen Ausstellung All Systems Fail in den Deichtorhallen Hamburg wurde Sarah Morris gefragt, wie sie ihre Kunst in zwei Sätzen beschreiben würde. It's about late capitalist forms and the direction in which the system is headed, war ihre Antwort. Die Arbeit von Sarah Morris soll also Ausformungen des Spätkapitalismus erkunden und danach fragen, in welche Richtung sich das System entwickelt, in dem wir leben. Die DNA der Großstadt, die Eindrücke, die Hochglanzbürogebäude in Manhattan vor dem inneren Auge hinterlassen, die Reizüberflutung an Orten wie dem Times Square, all das ist seit ihren künstlerischen Anfängen in den frühen 90er Jahren wichtiger Bestandteil der Arbeiten von Sarah Morris. In den Deichtorhallen Hamburg ist mit All Systems Fail eine große Retrospektive der US-amerikanischen Künstlerin zu sehen. Mit insgesamt über 180 Werken. Gemälde, filmische Arbeiten, Zeichnungen, Plakate und Skulpturen. Ein Überblick über 30 Jahre. Ich habe mit Sarah Morris über ihre Anfänge in der Kunstwelt von New York in den 90ern gesprochen und über ihr erstes Studio am Times Square. Damals noch ein wenig touristischer und eher zwielichtiger Ort. Außerdem erzählt Sarah Morris von ihren Filmen und darüber, wie sie sich manchmal hartnäckig gegen institutionelle Widerstände zur Wehr setzen musste. Warum ausgerechnet die Hamburger Elbphilharmonie im Mittelpunkt einer ihrer Filme steht und was das mit der Frankfurter Schule zu tun hat, auch darüber habe ich mit Morris gesprochen. Zuerst hat mich aber interessiert, ob sie selbst eine direkte Verbindung zwischen ihrer allerersten Arbeit, dem Defunct Manifest, und der aktuellen Ausstellung All Systems Fail in den Deichtorhallen sieht.
Absolutely. I definitely see a connection in the sense of, I mean, I think the themes in my work are about failure. And I've always been interested in failure and how to read the contemporary moment in terms of failure. I mean, obviously, all systems are functioning, but all systems are constantly failing. And this was evident to me very early on. I was brought up in a household with constant sort of talking about the media, talking about the fiction that goes on, talking about the double standards. So I was, you know, I was used to this idea of talking back, you know, this irreverence and being able to be aware of the contradictions that you're complicit in.
Do you remember the moment or the time around when you realized this is what I've got to do? I need to do art.
Well, this is a funny story. I do remember this very well. So when I was like, I have a very sharp memory of before I was three, my parents announced that we were going to New York City and we went, you know, we were going to go visit the museums. And my mother was very interested in art, although she was a nurse. And my father's a research scientist. So anyway, they announced that we were going to New York, and I was really excited. And I remember them packing the car. We lived about 4 hours from New York. And that was like the first time I was ever going to a city. And already I was super excited. I knew exactly what the Natural History Museum was. I knew what Museum of Modern Art was. I remember getting up on the little bench in the bathroom and looking at my face in the mirror to make sure I was ready for my future.
That's a beautiful story.
It's strange that I remember it, but I remember it very, very precisely.
That is strange because, I mean, before three, the age of three.
My brother wasn't alive.
Wow.
And so I was before three.
Yeah.
No, I don't remember, like, being in New York. I just remember the anticipation.
Yeah.
The moment before I got into the car.
You got on the creative path that kind of led you to today while you were studying Brown University.
It was
University.
Really before that.
Really before that. Okay.
Yeah, because my mother painted, even though, you know, she painted. She was very interested in art. Her mother painted. There was like several women on my mom's side that painted and that were interested in art. They didn't do it professionally, but they were very interested. So I grew up being encouraged.
Yeah.
Yeah, in this regard, yeah.
Do you remember the first time you did something like a painting or something that you would say already kind of maybe had traces of what you do today?
Yeah, I mean, I did a self-portrait that hangs in my house, which is sort of like a, it's almost like a self-portrait of me as Don Quixote. I'm on like a horse stroke dragon, and I'm sort of going somewhere, yeah? So I always, and I remember that that drawing was like framed and put in our back hall of our house, and it was the first thing anybody saw, and the first thing anybody saw as they left. So I remember doing that, and I also remember working a lot. I mean, I loved when people gave me art supplies, you know? I mean, I think every kid does, but I definitely remember thinking and associating art with travel, because my mother, we would go visit my American grandfather, who was in every winter, he would go to Florida and live in Florida. And we would go visit him. He worked for Bell Telephone. And for that trip, which was like a 3-hour flight, which was the only flight I ever did when I was a kid, I'd get to go to the store and get to buy all my supplies. And then you have that little table. And then so I sort of associated art with travel, actually, from a very early age, which is interesting that it's something you think about, this sort of in-between space when you're going somewhere or you're thinking about, you know, another place.
Yeah. You did go to school for something other than art in the first place,
yeah,
though,
that's
right?
True.
You studied like social political science. Within that frame, you kind of bumped into becoming an artist.
Well, it was interesting. Brown University, which is in Rhode Island in the United States, is a very well-known school, but it's well-known for liberal arts. It is not known for visual arts. I didn't go there to study that, but it was like, it was known that it was very progressive school. And I was very interested in reading everything. I mean, I just read an enormous amount when I was like a teenager. Yeah, I was like, you know, I know it sounds weird. It sounds sort of nerdy. But, you know, when I was 14, I was reading Noam Chomsky. My friends were reading it, yeah. And I was reading it. So this is very, I had a group of very unusual friends, and out of that sort of friendship came exposure to certain books. So I just read voraciously. I just read. And so when I got to Brown, I was studying political philosophy, and then there was a program called Semiotics, which was like film theory, critical theory, Frankfurt School, you know.
Yeah.
So it gave me an understanding of how to read history, in terms of creative production, how to read history critically, how to read texts as not just a simple sort of subjective force, but that production of, you know, creative production is also embedded in its time.
you came to New York City in 1989, I think.
Yeah.
You had a studio in the early 90s that was kind of close to Times Square, if I
understand.
It was in Times Square.
It wasn't close. It was on 42nd Street.
So for most non-New Yorkers or Europeans, you know, Times Square is this like fascinating tourist spot with like huge billboards. It's like hard to imagine these days it being an area where artists would work. So how can we imagine that place like in the late 80s, early 90s?
So when I arrived in New York, because I had done this manifesto defunct magazine, I didn't call it a magazine. I really called it a manifesto. Anyway, I published that in like February with a good friend of mine, and it got a lot of attention. Like nobody knew it was happening, and it was done very slick. And it was also collaborating with Jeff Koons and Hal Foster. We were reviewing a book that he had just published. It was about a book that Susan Sontag had just published. You know, it was covering a lot of things that were going on at that moment. It got a lot of attention. I was telling my assistant yesterday, there was this funny story how even Rolling Stone magazine found out about Defunct and called my department to speak to me, and they wanted to interview me about this thing because we had distributed it all over the East Coast. And we distributed it. It wasn't like we FedEx. We had no money. So we just, like, we got a ride to Boston. We got a ride to New York. I mean, we distributed it everywhere. I can't remember how many we printed. Probably only 2,000. It's never been reprinted. But anyway, that sort of led to a number of things that also led to me being invited to apply to the Whitney program, which I got in, which was very unusual because I had not made any art. And I had, you know, was quite young. I was only 21. So that was very extraordinary. And then I arrived in New York. But before I got to New York, because I had met Jeff before I moved to New York because he was involved with the magazine, I asked him if there would be any, because I needed to have some sort of income. So I asked him if there was something I could do to help him. And he said, absolutely, contact me at the end of August. So I did. And I remember calling him in Germany. And I sort of wrangled myself a job. And he didn't even have a studio. Like, he was really just sort of on the road. And I had a part-time job with him when I landed in New York already. That was organized before I arrived.
So you didn't even have to work any other odd part-time jobs or anything?
I never had any other job.
Wow, yeah.
Going back to New York, it was very small. Mm. I mean, the art world seemed like, you know, these people were like 15 years older than me. And obviously, I knew all of their work. But the art world was very small. It seemed very glamorous. It was all in Soho. Again, this group of people seemed like very, very far ahead, you know?
Yeah.
And my first studio was in Times Square, and I had several friends who were in that building. It was Andy Warhol's supposed favorite building. And I met the landlord guy, and they knew that Times Square was going to be redeveloped. And the redevelopment of Times Square went on forever, meaning it didn't happen, right? So the city planned it. I didn't get a lease. It was just month to month. And I think I paid like, I don't know, $250, maybe $300 for my studio. And it was beautiful. It was like faced south. I had a whole view of Times Square. And it was just big enough to be able to work on about, I don't know, at least about 8 paintings at a time. So that's where I really started to paint, in that room.
Yeah. When we enter the exhibition at Deichtorhallen, that's kind of, I feel like that's kind of what we walk into.
Yes.
Is that time, and also a lot of what the work that you did, I think, during.
Well, there was an adrenaline
time, right?
In Times Square. Mm. There was a guy right out the window. So I had a window that faced south, and I could see a guy on a little, what they call like a soapbox. You know, there was a guy on a soapbox with a microphone screaming. You know, he was like, I don't even know what he was talking about, but he would always be there. You would look out to the right. There would be Port Authority bus station, which is still there. There was an empty lot. Now it's definitely a building. There are very few empty lots in Manhattan now. And then there was the remnants of the porn industry, which started in Times Square and the peep shows and the magazine shops and the VHS tapes, all of that was like all around. So when you would walk to the studio, you'd have to walk by all these shops and, of course, all of the characters that would hang out around these shops. And then I would enter my building, which was 233 West 42nd Street. The Midtown paintings, though, were done in London.
Oh, they were done in London.
They were done in London, but the idea for them started in that studio.
Yeah,
I was fascinated by all this sort of juxtaposition between this sort of very early pornography and this sense of Americana, which was there in the coffee shops and the diners and the bars.
Yeah.
And then around the corner on 6th Avenue, it went super slick. Then you had all of the buildings, all the corporations. So it was a strange dichotomy. And the only reason there were artists in that building is just because it was about to get completely changed, because Disney made a deal with New York City to take over the Amsterdam Theater, and they got a lease for 100 years for free. Which should be an article in the New Yorker magazine, but hasn't been so far. But that was a Giuliani deal.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of very sketchy deals to change Times Square and get the pornography out. And we knew that that was going to happen. And so I only had that studio for a couple of years.
Yeah, so you were always kind of on the verge of, we might be gone tomorrow.
I mean, it seemed like it was going to be forever. I wasn't really worried about it at all. But I loved that studio.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
What I think is really interesting is that in those works, even though you made them in London, but you kind of have that, like, you know, I guess kind of like an after image of what it says, reflections of Times Square, you know, on one of your works.
I was probably, you know, I made a film before I made Midtown that I shot using my brother in Times Square, and he was like entering my studio building. And it was like and it wasn't really him. He was playing a part. He was sort of like a paranoid person with a gun who was like entering my studio building, because it was really sketchy. Mm. The area was super, you know, there was a lot of crime in that area. And there was a lot of prostitution probably in that area. And definitely it didn't feel particularly secure. There was a guy named Angel who was the security guard for our building, but he also seemed a bit sketchy. You know, it was, the whole thing was, you know, you were sort of on borrowed time. The landlord, though, loved artists.
For me, a lot of those buildings and the pictures, the paintings from that time seem like maps of like how we can perceive and get drawn into corporate structures, corporate architecture. But also then we have the dichotomy of what you just said, like the blinking lights and like the porn industry.
There's a lot of commercial language in my work. The fact that I wanted to be in Times Square was already like a decision. I liked this idea of being placed in the center. And I mean, even thematically, of that art, you know, to me, the people I was interested in as artists already when I was a student, the people who I was interested in did not treat like art as a marginal activity, meaning their subject matter was the mainstream. So if you believe that and think about that as a language, you would place yourself there, which is not dissimilar to the way I make my films, which I think about where would I like to place myself.
I was just going to start to ask you about some of your films, because I think it becomes very apparent that like your interest in like large scale economic and power structures. You have two films that are dealing with two of the probably most powerful corporate media, entertainment and also sport events. There's Beijing at the Olympics, Beijing 2008, and then there's Los Angeles, where we have scenes from the Oscars in 2004. And you're dealing with these big, powerful entities like the International Olympic Committee. seems like you're kind of peeling out these like layers of conspiracy-like structures within, you know, these complexes like the Olympics, the Oscars, Hollywood, Los Angeles, Miami.
Well, what was really interesting to me with the Olympics is obviously that's something as a model. I mean, it's an event that's staged, that's produced, that happens every 4 years. Let's even say 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay. But, and it connects all these cities across the world formally and also historically. And it connects them in this way where, of course, 1972 is linked to 2008 and linked to 1936 and so on and so on and so on. You have this like stacking up. And actually, the Olympics, when I say it's a produced event, you know, it is not produced internally in Beijing. So, you know, when I first went there and met with the local group that was handling the Olympics, of course, they said yes, yes, yes about doing what I needed to do. But actually, it was Switzerland. It was the main IOC that was really in control. And it's, that was sort of fascinating to me. And then they said no about three or four times until I actually traveled to Lausanne to have a meeting with them on a train. And after that, maybe there was a short period after that that they thought about it, and then they finally said yes, which I was almost in disbelief. Like when I got the email from them, I remember it was April 1st, and you know, I had had so many no's from them that I was in disbelief that they had actually changed their mind. But they did change their mind, and I don't know exactly what made them change their mind, but I didn't care. I was excited.
I think it's really interesting that in the exhibition, you have this transparency of that process, kind of. You have your paperwork and some communicative work, some letters, some laminates on show. And
well, I keep everything.
Yeah.
I keep everything important that I should say. I try to keep the process because I keep it for all types of reasons. I keep it legally. I keep it because it's important to remember who helped me and that sort of narrative of the how do you navigate?
How do you get into those places?
How do you get in? How do you get out?
Yeah.
How do you keep in contact? How do you, yeah. So I keep it for all many reasons. I mean, also there's, you know, every time we make a film, there is this stage of pre-production. Like I just shot a film recently in Hong Kong last month. And that went on, the pre-production phase for that film was 5 years. So, you know, we create, you know, sort of folders and binders for all the research and all. I mean, nowadays it's mostly digital.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you show us that in the exhibition because you kind of get a feeling for it must have been at some points, you know, must have been kind of difficult to get access to some of those places because I would imagine a thing like the Oscars to be so highly guarded because a lot of people are probably afraid of what you're going to show of them, you know, how is that film going to turn out? What light am I going to be seen in?
Of course. I mean, you have in Los Angeles, you have the ego as corporation. And you have to remember, so I did that in 2004. Then I catapult myself. I knew when I was shooting Los Angeles that I was then going to do Beijing. So you have the idea of the ego as a corporation, and then you have the idea of the nation state. And at that point in 2008, things looked very open. It was like you have this hyper-capitalist scenario, and maybe it goes this way, maybe it goes that way. We didn't know. There was a lot of speculation. There was a lot of debate, for sure, controversy. I remember Steven Spielberg pulling out of the Olympics because of an article that Mia Farrow and her son Ronan wrote in the Wall Street Journal about China. I mean, there was a lot of debate, but it was still a little bit speculative about what would happen in the future. And there was like an optimism also with the critique.
What I think is also very interesting is that in those films, the ambivalence of a spectacle like the Olympics, for example, it's so apparent in itself that you don't have to point a critical finger at it. And that's something that you are, if I understand correctly, not a fan of at all. Anyway, because you're creating art from an understanding of working within the system, not trying to pretend to be able to be on the outside.
Well, I think the whole notion, I mean, obviously, as I said, I read a lot before I ever made work. So I was already critical of the concept of the avant-garde. The avant-garde is a bit of a fiction. We know this historically. That they weren't a part. This idea of art as being autonomous from the structures of society is false. And you can look through history and see this. Also, at the same time, I liked this fiction of creating a studio, an art practice that had this like faux administration, right? Like you see it in some of the paperwork that we have. You see it in the name of my studio, which is Parallax, which is after Alan Pakula's film called Parallax View, which is about a journalist who takes a test in order to get hired by the Parallax Corporation. But he doesn't know what the Parallax Corporation does, but he has a feeling or an understanding it's something political, but he doesn't really know, and that's Warren Beatty. So I liked this idea of the faux administration, faux bureaucracy, and art is a bureaucratic. I mean, there is a bureaucratic side to art, right? I mean, there is the writing, there is the shipping, there is the selling, there is the promotion, and there is the spectacle also. So, you know, early work that I was interested in, I mean, I really loved the work of Marcel Brotas. I loved the work of Warhol, Richter, Judd, Louise Lawler. But there were many texts that I read in literature that informed me as much as seeing, you know?
Yeah.
I mentioned Joan Didion as being sort of like a very important person that helped me understand that there is no sort of objective voice and that these forces around us permeate our way of being and our way of seeing on all types of levels, like on the minute level and on the sort of ideological level.
A place that, or I would say a school of thought that you already mentioned had an influence on you, the Frankfurt School, critical philosophy.
Oh, I loved Adorno.
Social theory.
I was like obsessed with Adorno.
And I want to talk to you about that because in one of your films, Finite and Infinite Games, Alexander Kluge, someone who was a lawyer for the Institut für Sozialforschung, a student of Adorno in the 50s, he is the narrator, kind of, or you also talk with him in that film.
Basically, I was asked if I would be interested in shooting and using the Elbphilharmonie in a new film. And I was, of course, critical of the building and critical of the idea. But so I flew here and I saw the building and I was like, of course I can do something. It was still in construction. And I thought to myself, this building, aside from it being extraordinarily hubristic, I thought, and of course I knew all the sort of controversy about it and
the financial side.
Of course, I knew
so
all of that.
Controversy here.
But when I went in it, it felt like I was inside of a wasp's nest. When I was in it, it had this sort of acoustical element, like not dissimilar to what we're in right now. And I thought, what we really need is a warning. We really need a voice. And I started to think about this voice. I wanted it to be a male voice. I wanted it to be a German voice. I thought for a little while about using Werner Herzog, but I thought his voice was maybe too comic and too oversaturated, meaning too many people knew his voice.
Yeah.
And it would seem too much like him. So I approached Alexander Kluge because I thought it was very interesting that he had this background in filmmaking with Fritz Lang. I thought it was very interesting that he had this background in law through the Frankfurt School and the reparations that happened after World War II. Also, he's a poet. He's a writer. This idea of the interdisciplinary aspect of making, of navigating, really, of making work or living your life or whatever you want to call it, I thought he was an interesting sort of model. So in the film, he speaks, he's answering questions about how that happened, the course of his life, his work life, that is. And he's also reading a script that I put together. And I remember he called me and I was like, when he called me, I'd written to him to ask him to do this. And when he called me, finally, you know, there was like a week or so that went by. And then he called me and I was in a taxi going up Sixth Avenue and I was in front of a button and ribbon shop. There's like all this textile stuff still in New York City. I mean, it's dying, but it's there. And I remember him saying to me, "I'm not an actor, you know." And I said, "I know, but I never use anybody as actors. I don't. I use them for themselves. I use them for what already exists. I would never, you know, actually direct anybody.
Yeah.
I use them as ready-mades."
Yeah, I think it's really interesting in that film about, or the Elbphilharmonie in Hamburg, a building that is so controversial, or at least it was, you know, in that those whole years it was being built, this critique of how prestigious architecture comes together and what all goes into that, and kind of like contradict that with a human experience, and Alexander Kluge talking about like his kind of life.
Well, he goes into like, he's reading my script, which is about game theory and about this sort of navigation of the self in relation to these other forces, let's just say. But then he goes into, you know, World War II and sort of, you know, the subject of war, the subject of how a society is like really barely held together, the forces. And it's, you can't tell sometimes when he's just making things up and when he's actually reading my script.
Yeah.
Which is nice. It's like flickering back and forth. Sometimes you can, but sometimes you can't. It's very slippery.
Yeah. Going back and forth between mediums, your films and your paintings, and you get asked a lot how those two connect. And I think with that film, with Alexander Kluge, it's kind of really apparent how that connects, because you have one of your works in your graph paintings.
Is the sound graph pieces.
Sound graph pieces is...
I think the voice has always been in my work. The early text paintings, it is an American voice. It is a voice of this sort of pop psychology or tabloid-esque, which is obviously everywhere. You know, it's not just in the New York Post. It's in, you know, the New York Times or the Washington Post also, maybe to a lesser extent, but it's still there, this way of reading stories and the way of distilling stories or streamlining stories. But the voice and the adrenaline and the noise, even when you're looking at the Midtown paintings or the Los Angeles paintings, this sense of this color, these forms, how they influence you, how they shape our behavior, how they affect the event, what maybe the event is off in the perimeter, but you're still thinking of this sort of, you know, the psychology of aspiration, the psychology of suppression. Mm. You're thinking about this. There's something about the scale of my paintings, which they are larger than you, and they somehow command you, like me even. You know, they like when they work, they're somehow in charge.
Yeah, yeah, they're engaging you. I thought it was very interesting what you just said about an American voice. I found this quote of yours where you said you have to be engaged with things that you find repulsive or problematic. That's important when you're making art. And I feel like that could be kind of connected to what you just said about like the American voice. Is that something that you still have like at the core of what kind of keeps you going?
Well, as an artist, I think you have to place yourself in all the time difficult situations. And whether you acknowledge them or not is your problem. A lot of people don't acknowledge them. And maybe that is like just suppressed as a, you know, not a theme in their work. For me, these issues or things are actually themes in my work. They are the work. I mean, I could say failure is a subject in my work. Capitalism is a subject in my work. architecture is a subject in my work. Entertainment is a subject, like the spectacle.
Yeah.
I mean, I think when we're talking, also, I just wanted to add, one of the books I really loved when I was studying was Society of the Spectacle, of course.
Guy Debord.
Yeah, that was like, and I was fascinated by all of those characters. And also the failure, you know, of like what happened. You know, but you see it, it's not really a failure, but on some level it is. But I was fascinated by the Situationists. Absolutely. But I don't think it's particularly American. I mean, I don't think this aspect of dealing with forces that are repulsive or that are contradictory,
mm-hmm.
I think we all can say every single one of us has to deal with this. It's just what you do.
But,
that.
You know, not a lot of people, I think today it sometimes takes some courage, actually, to be open about engaging with those kind of things, you know, that while others kind of listen more to like subcultural, like resistance viewpoints, moments of countercultural things. And I think for an artist, it is definitely, at least from my perspective, I think it's interesting if you choose to be open about, I don't consider myself as resisting. I do that, but I do that by engaging with what mm-hmm. I could be resisting.
Mm-hmm. I think engagement can be a very powerful tool if it's done with a sense of humor and done with a sort of style that hasn't existed before. I think engagement can lead to something interesting. Doesn't always, of course.
During the pandemic, you kind of left the grids that you sometimes work with, and also, I guess, physically probably left the grids of the urban sphere, and you created work that's inspired by, for example, lunar phases or spider webs. How did those themes that are kind of like more rooted in nature, I would say, how did those come into your work?
Well, I left the city like most people did. I mean, New York, it was like sort of an extreme situation that was starting to transpire. And I think I left New York in like mid-March, and I went up to Massachusetts where I have a place. And, you know, it was, and I will never forget leaving New York. I mean, the highway was empty, not full. The highway was completely empty, and I was driving, and I remember looking in the rearview mirror with the city, so this is the opposite of the three-year-old story.
Yeah.
There, in the rearview mirror, there was like the city, and I'm driving, and I'm speeding away from the city. And it felt slightly liberating, but also incredibly scary, because I wondered why was no one else on the highway. The idea of the city failing, or society failing, that is an organic thing, as we know now. I mean, this is like, I don't think we can look at the city as a non-organic structure. The city is organic too. If you start to look at it as a theme, there's always been a lot of natural forms in my work. In the Rio series, even in the Chicago film, there's a spider web pictured right outside of the Chicago Tribune printing facility, which also prints the New York Times and prints most of the papers on the East Coast. It's an enormous facility that printing. I love printing. I love paper. And I love the whole printing process. You know, when I started to sort of reflect on this sort of dysfunction that was going on, like this epic dysfunction that was transpiring during the pandemic, it was impossible not to look at these improvised forms, or what seem like improvised forms of the spider web, as some form of like, maybe there's something to be learned in these forms. Maybe they are, you know, because this idea of creating a habitat that's flexible, this idea of creating a habitat that produces food that is a protection, and yet it's so beautiful and also ripped and messed with. I mean, they're never perfect,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like they're an improvised form that it doesn't
work in process.
Yeah, yeah, that it's just like, okay, mm. not even sure anybody's there, you know?
Yeah.
You find these things, and the spider web was like a sign also of my displacement, the displacement from the city and the sort of architecture, you know, therein.
The only reason I'm going to ask this question, which is related to gender, is mm-hmm. that we've heard so much about sexism and like patriarchal hierarchies, power structures in the music and the film industry. But what about the art world and business? Like that, it seems like there's not that many, like, you know, voices. There wasn't that kind of a thing like there was with Me Too from the film industry. What were your experiences as an upcoming artist concerning that?
Well, you know, when I started and when I thought about the art world or being an artist, it never ever crossed my mind that there was any type of problem, because I looked to the work of Rosemary Trockel, Barbara Kruger, Louise Lawler, Jenny Holzer, Sherry Levine.
You had role models.
I saw their work, and
yeah.
it was so strong, and it was so seriously around. You know, there were it never occurred to me that there was any type of issue. It's only when you actually really start to really work and gain momentum that you start to sort of see it. I didn't see it really as a student. I'm sure it was there. I just didn't see it. I have seen it, of course, and it's ugly. You can easily, I mean, there was a big article in Die Zeit a few years ago, and they used an image of me. Stanford published an article and did research about auction prices since 1970 and determined that since 1970 to now, women artists get half of what their contemporary male artists, colleagues, get.
So there's a pay gap in that sense, too, in the art world.
Well, I mean, there's also the irony of that nobody makes any money from the auction houses.
Right.
Like, that's the irony of that story. But the point is that, you know, the auction houses, the way they promote work, the way they decide how it rolls, obviously there's sexism in those decisions. But I think, hopefully, you know, this is being, will be corrected. But they have a long way to go, right?
I can only imagine, like, concerning exhibitions, too. Like, what kind of galleries do you get to put your work in?
Yeah. Yeah, there's that, too. There's, I mean, the thing is, like, the galleries that I show with have quite good track records. Maybe some don't. There are galleries that haven't really shown many women or create, you know, helped to create somebody's career.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the people that I've been involved with have worked really hard on that front and are sort of my biggest advocates, and I go to them with all types of problems. But, I mean, you definitely, it's around, it's pervasive. There's a reason why Hillary Clinton wasn't elected. I mean, there's still a lot of bias around, and you know, I think the only thing that you can do with that is be very cognizant of it, speak out very clearly when you see it as much as you can, and carry on, you know?
Do your thing.
I mean, you have to sort of ignore it.
Yeah.
But call it out when you see it. You know, these forces that are, let's just call it discriminatory, obviously that's changing now, and hopefully it changes a lot more.
Back to the title of your exhibition at Deichtorhallen, All Systems Fail. When you were asked a couple days ago, what would you say your art is about? You know, just like really that brief question. You said about late capitalist forms and examining the direction in which the system is headed. Would you say that's kind of how you understand your role as an artist in some ways, kind of opening up dialogue about future?
Well, it also has to be said that I want to create moments of beauty, too. You know, I mean, the idea of being seductive in this whole process of creating something that is literally a portal to another place, another state of mind, a better place, a more magical place, is something that I think about a lot. And I try to do that with my work, and it definitely elevates myself. Meaning when I walk into my studio, I feel like a sort of thing around me that somehow changes my, you know, changes my mood, changes my psychology. And basically, it is more than just the history of ideas. I mean, that idea that you expressed a minute ago that I said a couple days ago walking through the Deichtorhallen. I mean, of course, there is the history of ideas, which I feel very connected to, absolutely, very strongly connected to. But it's also, there's something about art that's like very visceral, that's very beautiful, where you're creating moments that are very unique, that really like no one else can do other than you. And those are very sort of powerful moments to have. And I think sort of art also functions on a way where it's like, I don't know, it's giving energy and a picture and a map of where to, how to be, how to operate, how to move through the world. And so on a level, like, you know, on a just personal level.
Offering perspectives, solutions.
Yeah. On a personal level, it becomes your face, art. You know, it becomes your modality and it governs you. So I love that, that there's this aspect of me that's like producing me.
I think that's a really great last word.
Thank you
so much.
Thank you for having me.
Es gibt kein richtiges Leben im Falschen, aber es kann Schönheit im Falschen geben. So würde Sarah Morris vielleicht den Satz von Adorno ergänzen, der sich bei dem Protagonisten der Frankfurter Schule auf das Nachkriegsdeutschland bezieht, der aber heute häufiger als sowas wie ein Kalenderspruch auftaucht und eher seltener als tatsächlich kultur- und gesellschaftskritischer Denkanstoß. Intensive und einzigartige Momente schaffen. Innerhalb des Geflechts aus System, Gesellschaft und Konsumspektakel, in dem wir leben, weil es kein Außerhalb gibt. Darum geht es Sarah Morris. Das war mein Gespräch mit Sarah Morris. Ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Mehr Infos zu Sarah Morris und der Ausstellung All Systems Fail in der Halle für aktuelle Kunst der Deichtorhallen Hamburg findet ihr in den Shownotes dieser Folge. Und wenn euch der Podcast gefällt, dann hinterlasst uns gerne eine Bewertung oder empfehlt ihn weiter. Ihr könnt uns auch gerne schreiben und zwar an dasistkunst@deichtorhallen.de. Wir freuen uns über euer Feedback und hören uns hoffentlich wieder in der nächsten Folge von Das ist Kunst, dem Podcast der Deichtorhallen Hamburg in Zusammenarbeit mit Byte FM. Tschüss und bis bald.